Hey, kids.
You're listening to the internet's wettest podcast about video games, consoles,
and pancakes.
The SML Podcast.
What's up, everybody? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe, and I still sound weird, but it's a party cast. Tim is here, Chris is here, Purnell is here, and Brooke's not, but we got someone with hair. Ian Griffin is here. Doc Havoc, how are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, Joe.
How's everyone else doing?
I don't sound weird, so that's a start.
Yeah. Wow. Doing pretty solid. Doing pretty
well. I do sound weird, but that's normal.
Yeah, so I still don't have any teeth. My temporary dentures do not fit me, which is fun. So I gotta.
The bone thing you mentioned before, is this something different?
Yeah, the bone thingy, and then the bottom is just like scraping the skin. So I'm going for an appointment tomorrow, and then I have another one on Thursday. So hopefully by the end of the week, I sound okay.
Yay.
All right. Yay.
We're rooting for your mouth and rooting for the music, because music's where your mouth is. So, hoping for the best for you.
What, are we That's getting to the music already? Is the episode over? Did I miss it?
All right, what a great episode.
Damn.
Man, time flies.
Thanks for being here, guys. It was a really good one.
So many good games.
My favorite episode I've ever been in.
Absolutely fantastic.
So, Ian, how's things going with you? How's your streaming been going?
Well,
that sounds like streaming.
Sounds about as good as we're doing.
Is this kind of like a subtle roundabout way to ask me about the interesting weather phenomena I went through last week?
I mean, sure, you could talk about that.
Okay, so apparently last Tuesday, we got a absolute shatting of the heaviest, wettest, slushiest snow I've seen in a very long time.
Whoa.
So bad, in fact, that it knocked out the entire power grid for the area.
Are you in our area, too, or are you somewhere else?
I am not in Joe's area.
Yeah, that's where I'm at, too. That's why I was like...
Okay, I'm totally not in Joe's area.
I'm also not in Joe's area.
I am. I try to avoid Joe's area at all costs, really.
Yeah. I think Tim might know where I'm at. But I'm upstate New York. Yeah. But anyways, yeah, so it was so bad that it knocked out the power grid for the entire region. Like, I don't think the town that I live by got power for like 24 hours. Jeez. Because there were trees down, there were branches, like everything just got royally fucked.
In fact, happy spring.
Yeah, like in fact, the power went out halfway through a stream. It was while I was doing like a little intermission break, and the power went out, and like, I guess I'll just wait. Well, 3.5 days later, I got my power back. Yeah, I got my power back at like 4 p.m. on Friday. The power went out like around midnight on Tuesday. So
I've been thankful not to deal with that. Like, I've had power loss, but never over a period of actual multiple days. If there's anything that makes you realize just how much we depend on that shit for some semblance of a quality of life, that'll fucking do it.
I basically had to like restock like 98% of my fridge and freezer.
Damn.
And on top of that, we had about 2 to 3 feet of snow in one dump, and it all melted within a day.
What?
So you had flooding too?
Yes.
Oh.
So So basically, everything melted within a day. Like, I didn't even really have to worry about blowing out my driveway, because I sure as shit wasn't going anywhere. There's nowhere to go to. Everything was down. It was, you know, the governor of New York actually came through my area and said, "Yep, this place be fucked."
And you weren't exaggerating at 2 to 3 feet.
Yeah. I have a tree that is just completely tipped over, uprooted on my property, and there are like two other trees that are gonna have to be completely removed by professionals, because I do not have a cherry picker to chop that much wood, nor the space to store it. In fact, my best friend, he told me he had 6 trees down in his property, plus a few other bushes. But yeah, we got wrecked. So not only did all these trees and stuff come down, causing road closures, but the next day, the temperature was up in like the mid to high 60s, so everything flash melted and flooded the fuck out of everywhere. So, yeah.
Damn. Tim, did your New York experience match up to that in the past week?
No, not in the past week, no. I actually haven't had a prolonged power outage since I moved to this house, so, you know, knock on all things made of wood and make sure they don't fall on my house.
But, yeah. And I remember, yeah, because the only way I could charge my phone was in my car.
Damn. That sucks.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, it is what it is.
Freaking phone company was like, well, 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 the value of our product comes knocking again. What happened? The land lies rise again.
Unless the phone lines are down, too.
In which case, they would call
back. Oh, yeah, everything was down.
Yeah.
Everything was down.
Chris, how was your week?
Oh, pretty good. Lots of playing Super Nintendo. Revisiting the classics.
What classics?
Well, I guess the only like real interesting one that I've been playing lately is I started a game of Final Fantasy VI, and I decided that I'm going to do a solo Gao challenge.
Oh, you mentioned that.
Yeah. So I'm almost at the floating continent now. And so it's been pretty cool. Like, it turns out the kid, he can do more than you think. So, yeah.
He can do a lot. I used Gao a lot when I played through that game. Like,
me too. I always considered him a very underrated character.
Absolutely. Like, he just casts things for free and has a lot of utility.
Yeah.
If you know what you're doing.
But using him solo, I have a hard time picturing how that works. Like, fighting, like, I remember when I was younger, playing it for the first time, having trouble with the bosses at Vector, even though they are kind of like a gimme boss after you survive long enough.
Right. But
I have trouble picturing, like, Gao fighting bosses like that by himself. Like, yep, I'm just going to not die here.
What did I do for number 28? I think that I just threw on, what did I do? Yeah, the Vector bosses, I did have to alter my strategy for like one or two of them or something like that. I have to remember. I am actually planning on streaming through it at some point, so I'll have a more like concrete like, you know, method of doing things.
Would you have to do the challenge a second time after doing it the first time?
Yeah, gotta do it for an audience, but I gotta make sure I can do it first.
Yeah.
It's like one time I did the probably the craziest thing I've done with Final Fantasy VI is on an actual cart, I did the glitch to... Well, this is going to be spoilers, so folks, if you haven't played Final Fantasy VI by now, then what are you doing with your life? But, okay, so there's a revive... Not a revive, but a glitch where you can put General Leo in your party after he's killed.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I did that on an actual cart, which requires about a 10-hour playthrough of without saving.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, you have to make it all the way through the game to the floating continent twice.
Why and, twice? Like, how does that even work for twice?
Oh, Lord. The first part of the glitch basically is you save outside of the cave in South Figaro with Locke and Celeste, right?
Yeah.
And at that point in the game, like, there's something that you can trigger. And you get all the way to the floating continent, and you have to jump off the floating continent and back onto your airship, and then jump off that airship back onto the floating continent and die. And then your game loads back at Locke and Celeste, and the airship's right there. It actually loads in the airship to saves wherever you saved it, as long as you jumped off of the floating continent onto the ship and then from the ship to the floating continent and died. That basically lets you place the airship anywhere. And then from there, you can plant yourself in a different part of the game and then do it over again. And then basically, you know, you manipulate some things and eventually it will allow you to finish out the Locke and Celeste scenario, and when you load up the Terra, Bannon, and Edgar scenario, then Bannon has been replaced by General Leo.
Whoa!
Yeah,
that's
so you get
pretty awesome.
Yeah, so you get to, like, and there's a couple other ways to manipulate that where you can have General Leo in a couple of different parts of the game, but it's very unstable, and, you know, you can't do much. You can't, like, and you can't bring him to the World of Ruin, and you can't change your characters, otherwise he'll revert back to what the game data thinks he should be.
Speaking of Final Fantasy VI things that you can't do, did anybody see the new statue?
unless it's a statue that brings back General Leo, permanently.
No,
the $14,000 statue.
Yeah,
well, it's like $13,800. It's 1/6 scale.
Yeah, it's 30 inches tall.
If you afford to be able to pay for that statue, General Leo himself will come back from the dead to thank you.
Yeah. There's only going to be 600 made. So, you know, 600 people are apparently going to buy that thing.
And not through lack of material. That's just how many they think they'll ever sell.
Which may be ambitious.
It looks cool, but, you know.
Yeah, it looks great, but it's not $14,000 great.
I think I feel like I remember hearing like Hironobu Sakaguchi like mocked it.
Yeah, something like that. Probably.
I saw a headline, but I did not read an article that led me to believe that something like that may be true.
Like, this is a really dumb idea. Why would you bastardize my baby like this? Oh yeah, for money.
I mean, it's awesome. It's just expensive.
I like the bold choice to make her the Amano concept art Terra with blonde hair so that she actually doesn't resemble anybody that's in the actual video game.
There's a little bit of a green tint to it.
Yeah, I'm sure they added that in. I'm not sure, actually.
Hard fans will understand.
The green tint is the money.
True. I like green hair Terra, though. She's cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what else is cool? Video games.
Air conditioning.
Yeah.
I don't know, though. Video games that aren't Final Fantasy VI.
I don't know. We got a couple to talk about tonight that might be good.
Oh, wait, hang on. Elden Ring.
Oh, okay.
No, you can go on.
But Brooke's not here.
Yeah, I figured we couldn't get through the segment without saying it once out loud.
Oh, just got to say it. Yeah.
Tim, did you have any good Elden Ring adventures this week?
I mean, I'm starting actually to wind down a little bit, finally.
Oh.
Had I platinumed it last time we talked?
I don't know, but damn. That's impressive.
Not really. It just takes time. Like, the achievements are pretty... I don't know, reasonable in this one. Like the most time, like getting three endings was the most time consuming thing, and it didn't even take up that much more time. Like after I finished the game at like 120 hours, it only took me another 10 to run through it two more times, and that was with some dicking around. So then, of course, I started another character, and that's going a bit slower. It's like, you know, I don't know, maybe. Time to be weaning off the Elden Ring after I played it for 140 hours now.
Damn. So what's next?
40?
It's a pretty good game. Well, it's games that I can't talk about because they're, well, I guess there's two games I can talk about, but there's what's really drawing my attention I can't talk about yet. So
if it's the same thing that I'm thinking of, next week is going to be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, we should probably talk about this week.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, might as well. We got a bunch of games to talk about tonight. First one is Blast Brigade versus the Evil Legion of Dr. Creed, developed by Allod's Team Arcade, published by My.Games, released April 13th on Xbox One, Series X and S, Switch, PS4, PS5, and PC for $19.99. Blast off in a 2D Metroidvania adventure bursting with platforming thrills, deep exploration, and explosive action. Assemble a crack team of heroes to save the world in Blast Brigade. Tim, tell us about your time with this one.
All right, Blast Brigade. So this is really base overview. This is kind of a very kid-friendly, I don't know, not like Metroidvanias are generally like fucking tits and gore all over the place, but this is definitely, you know, aimed at a younger crowd. I feel like just kind of looking at the graphics and the tone and everything. It's kind of like a, I don't know. It's like a 90s cartoon, like perceiving the Cold War. I guess, you are a, like, cause it is Cold War era, because your secret agent dude, Jeff Jefferson, that's his name. You know, he encounters a Russian lady and, you know, calling her red and Soviet and talking about communism stuff. So I'm like, OK, it's set in like the 70s or at least early 80s or maybe 60s or something like that. But it's, you know, kind of general. It's just like the cartoony kind of goofy or Cold War as it was perceived, you know, not while it was happening, but maybe in the radical decade that followed. So yeah, anyway, Biff Biffington or whatever his name is, he gets dropped out of his plane onto this island where he's pursuing a guy, an evil mad scientist whose name he can never remember. And yeah, you start rolling around. You start out with just like a normal ass assault rifle, you can run out of bullets in it, but they automatically reload. So you have infinite bullets. You just kind of have to pause sometimes for it to refresh. And you will start picking up other guns and other abilities that let you traverse the world. Stop me if you've heard this one before.
Kind of like a Metroidvania.
Well, yeah, some abilities will unlock other paths in the game. But, you know, the guns are just kind of for rootin', tootin', and shooting. So that's and those, like, your sub weapons are limited ammunition. Like, you have to pick up ammo packs to restore their ammo, which I'm kind of like, man, I don't know. Maybe just I guess I'm sure it was OP in testing, but I'm just like, just give me more shotgun ammo, which you can get if you do some upgrading. Kind of the main hook of the game is that you will be encountering other characters, and there is a plot mechanism that lets you swap between them on the fly, and each character will have a different traversal ability to help you get around the world. So the first one you pick up is a Soviet spy who has a grappling hook who lets you grapple up on things, and you've seen these grapple points kind of here and there throughout the game, and you're like, oh, okay, that's how I'm doing that. Yeah, when I got to that point in the game, I was like, oh, okay, that's the thing in this game, I guess, that is here to set it apart from other Metroidvanias. And other characters will also have other weapons, so they will play differently. Like your main character, his thing, he has a grenade launcher, which you can use to blow up certain walls and enemies. Turns out enemies don't like grenades. so, yeah. You got your primary weapons, your sub weapons, you get like, you know, an air dash as well that carries over between characters. There will be save points scattered around, and the game does not checkpoint outside of the save points, which I'm going to say should be considered a problem, just because they are not that close together, and it can definitely take some time. Like, you're not just zipping through areas, and they can be rather large, so it can take you a bit of a while to get back to your stuff. That's right, because when you die, you drop a chunk of money there, because why not make this game like Dark Souls? Kids love Dark Souls, right? You don't drop all of your money. I think it's just 100. I swear one time it was a little bit more than that, but I believe it is just 100. It's not percentage based or anything. You just drop 100 coins where you die. And if you get back to that spot or somewhere in the vicinity of that spot, it wasn't always the exact place. Like, sometimes it was way before the spot where I died. Sometimes it was a little bit after the spot where I died, which was kind of confusing. At a certain point, a bug starts eating your money and flying around. that is kind of funny. But yeah, you have to go back and get that stuff or else it's gone. You can spend. So there's a whole like base building or colonization mechanic, because there are natives on this island. You're just like, okay, we're just going to set up a base on your village. and that takes a couple forms that, like, yes, of course, immediately once you get this one guy back there, he sets up a shop where you can buy items. But also on the world, you'll find these like equipment repair, like, you know, supply kits, and those supply kits are what you use to build new things in your village. So finding them, and they'll be hidden, you know, kind of off the beaten path, as things in these types of games are wont to do. You want to find them so you can build up more stuff in your base and upgrade your characters more. Your character gets a... It's not really a skill tree. Like, you can attach gadgets to your spy watch, basically, which will give you passive bonuses. But, like, this is... There's like six branches of it, and you need a battery to activate each branch, and each, and some things are like, you know, there's like level one type upgrades, level two type upgrades, level three, and so on. Some that are more powerful. You can only have one of each level equipped. And like, if you don't have enough batteries to power them all, you got to kind of pick and choose what branch you want to power. This probably sounds more complicated than it is.
Yeah, but looking at a screenshot, it kind of makes sense what you're talking about.
Yeah, but it's just the added, I think, layer of, like, it's not just, oh, you pick one skill from this tree. It's like, oh, you have to, like, decide what tree you want to power with a battery. So there's just, like, a bit of an extra layer there.
So Purnell would never pick one.
Hey!
We know your decision paralysis. You can't deny that one.
I'd rather die than make a decision.
We'll just have the most bare bones village ever.
Yeah, but you can only change those at the save points, which are little hammocks that are scattered. And I will give the game credit in that even though they are spread out, like, it usually will put like a little sign, like, if on the previous screen that says hammock this way. So that way, you know, you're not just kind of running by all of the save points, which is also something that can happen in this game. If you're just like, okay, well, I can go left or right here, and you keep going the route that doesn't have any save points, at least this, it kind of is like, hey, over here, there's a save point, go get it. So that's cool. Fast travel is fast traveling, of course, is there'll be motorcycles parked around that you can jump on and drive, but they are not as frequent as I would like them to be for a game where you're going to need to be backtracking around the world to, you know, theoretically go back with new abilities and uncover new stuff. It's like, there's just not that many of them. And I think that's everything, kind of the overview of the mechanics and stuff. What really struck me about this game is not really much. It's pretty generic and straightforward in terms of the genre. The character switching mechanic isn't like, you know, a mind blower. It's like, okay, this is a thing that you're doing, but it just kind of, really what I think it does more than anything is just simplify the controls, which is fair considering, you know, if you think of Metroid Dread and kind of the finger gymnastics you had to do to use all the moves and that game. Here it's like each character only has their kind of one or two traversal abilities, so when you're on one character, you know, that's all you got to worry about at that time. But just kind of the feel of the shooting and the level design, like, it didn't really stand out to me, didn't really make a big impression on me. Like, I do think, like, graphically, like, it looks really nice. Like, I think the characters are drawn well. The environments look good. Like, nothing about this looks like cheap or, you know, kind of copy and paste with stuff, but
it just doesn't just stand out from the crowd.
Yeah, it just didn't really stand out from the crowd. Like, a lot of times when I'm playing these games, when I'm playing the best of the genre, it's like, I can't put the game down. But in this case, I was like, yeah, I can put the game down. like, no problem. I wasn't really feeling that push to move forward, especially when I would die very far from a save point. I was like, okay, it's time to do something else for a while. And for what it's worth, for a game that is maybe aimed at a younger crowd, my child, like, watched me play it for about 20 minutes. He was like, Dad, can you go back to Elden Ring? I was like, no, buddy, I have to play it for a review. But then, actually, the next day, he was asking me about playing it. So, you know, the fickle...
You'll disappoint your son.
Yeah, the fickle the fickle feelings of a near 7-year-old.
Oh, man. Well, the game's $20. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, it's worth it, for sure. It's just not going to blow any minds. It's like, really, if you want to scratch that itch and you want something that is totally competent at it, this will be the thing. And really there isn't a ton, like, I mean, the shooting is a bit more actiony. Like, it is 360 degree aiming. It's not, I wouldn't call it Contra or Metal Slug or anything, but you don't always see that it's usually, yeah. I don't know.
Is it like twin stick aiming?
A little bit. Yeah. It's a little bit twin sticky.
All right. Well, next game to talk about is Turnip Boy Commits Tax Evasion, developed by Snoozy Kazoo, published by Graffiti Games, released April 19th on Xbox One and Series X and S for $14.99. Also available as part of Xbox Game Pass, take control of an adorable turnip who happens to be an absolute menace to society. After failing to pay taxes and getting evicted from your home, you must go on an epic quest to pay back your massive debt to Mayor Onion. Along the journey, uncover what's spoiling this garden community and rise to tear down the corrupt vegetable government. Pernell, tell us about your time with Turnip Boy Commits Tax Evasion.
I was mostly intrigued by the fact that the nemesis is my least favorite vegetable. So that was go time there. So the idea
of your least favorite vegetable,
the yellow onion.
Okay. All right.
Nasty.
Yeah. Not onions chosen. Suck.
I love onions.
Fuck you.
Yeesh.
We're going to have a fight over onions.
Onions, buy it. Buy them.
Well, Turnip Boy's on our side. That's all that matters. Because Turnip Boy's got a bone to pick with the mayor, because the very beginning of the game, the first image you see is a massive tax bill. Why is it that high? Boo. But it's high, and you're supposed to pay it. But the game doesn't even give you a choice. The game says read it or rip it. Turnip Boy has a real penchant for tearing documents apart. So he does this. The mayor shows up and says, well, you're indebted to me, new minion. And he sets you out to run a series of tasks for him as your new role of being his servant, who is now officially in, like, I guess, debtor's prison, essentially. The debtor's servitude, we'll say. And the gameplay loop of this is fulfilling requests for him while also kind of helping other townsfolk with their requests. Though sometimes they're not so much as helping as much as being a jerk to them and still getting a reward somehow. The gameplay, though, is sort of a top-down, I don't want to call it a Zelda-like, but I guess it kind of is, so I'll call it a Zelda-like.
Yeah, I think that's fair. That's totally fair.
Because, like, you're basically tasked, like, the first thing you have to do is pretty much go to get a weapon, which ends up being a sword that is hidden in a glade, very reminiscent of the Master Sword Glade in Link to the Past, which I kind of chuckled at. But the first piece of equipment you actually get, which is something I did kind of like in this game, is a watering can, because a lot of the power-ups and manipulable actions in the game involve you watering plots of land and growing objects from that plot of land to do things. Like, you might, plant, water to ground and a movable block will pop up, or some sort of teleportation device will pop up when you water the ground, because this world is freaking wild. So you're generally running around mostly with the sword in this watering can, but you'll also sometimes come across additional support items, because the Zelda light part comes into play, where typically each request for the mayor ultimately involves you going into some sort of like miniature dungeon-esque place, a dungeon that uses alliteration, which I kind of like. Everything is alliteration in this game, happy home, or I don't know, Weapon Woods, Rocky Ramp. I was like, kind of smiled about that. But you'll end up going through these dungeons, going from room to room, solving some particularly light puzzles, and again, fulfilling requests for people in the dungeons or also outside of them. And while you're in there, you'll usually come across one piece of equipment that will give you a new ability for the rest of the game, and then also will be used to allow you to defeat the boss of the dungeon. Dungeon rewards you with a plot of land that you water to get a heart container. A lot of the side quests that I mentioned before also typically reward you with a heart container that you have to get by watering the earth. The game itself is actually, hush up. No one cares about if that was a spoiler to a player, I don't know what to tell them. You're rewarded with
blew that puzzle for someone. They were like, I spent 20 years working on that puzzle.
I didn't think somebody would come along and go, ground, I should water that, fuckers. But like, it's pretty interesting in the fact that nothing in this game felt particularly challenging or difficult, and it's kind of funny that the main character can't talk to anybody, so like, he has no characterization aside from the actions you have him do, which is, again, destroying every piece of legal document you come across in the game.
and even in some cases not particularly legal, could just like a love letter to somebody, like deliver this letter, game lets you look at it, and then you just tear it in half. And there's an achievement for that. But the achievement for destroying every document in the game, every individual document. I thought that was kind of funny. And there's a checklist too. The game has a checklist of documents you will come across that you need to destroy. They don't reveal them all to you, but you can at least see how long the list is. This is how many documents this young man is going to vandalize by the end of his adventure. It's kind of nifty there. I found myself laughing at a fair bit of the dialogue. Nothing that's going to make you blow, that's going to blow your mind or nothing like that. Nothing's going to make you break out of the source, but it does make you chuckle here and there. I also came, originally I thought the music was going to be kind of meh, because it was one of those games where the first area of the game, you just kind of hear the same like, doop, 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 loop, for way too many screens. But then the moment you get to the first like main dungeon, which is like the farmhouse, it's like an abandoned farmhouse or something, something that starts with F, it ends up being, you know, the music changes for the better. Honestly, it might have been, maybe. I just came across a movie where the plot is like porn stars go to film in a farmhouse and a serial killer shows up. So, hey, you were kind of on the nose there. It's called X, and it has like Kid Cudi.
That movie, okay.
Like, he sung a song for Sonic the Hedgehog, now he's getting murdered with porn stars. Kid Cudi's on the move! But...
Yeah, but is Turnip Boy on the move?
Turnip Boy is stabbing and watering his way to avoiding paying that tax debt, or at least getting the mayor killed. We'll find out. But as far as I'm concerned, I think the game is a fun time. It's not going to scratch any particular itches of like epic adventure or anything like that. But as a little like weird, cute aside of a game that'll probably occupy about 10 hours or so of your life, I think it's fun. It's enjoyable to me.
Cool. Anyone else play this?
Yeah, I played it and reviewed it for this very podcast last year.
Any thoughts you want to chime in with?
No, I think it's fantastic. I only played it. I got through like everything in this game in like an hour and a half, 2 hours.
I'm really finicky.
I guess so. But it's on Game Pass. It just got released on Xbox, and it is just it's really fun. It is just a fun fucking game, god damn it. it is a delight. It is charming.
It's fun fucking frolic and got with the alliteration all the way across.
It is not going to, you know, destroy you or your psyche, which is it's a great game to spend some time with.
Cool.
$15.
What do you guys say?
I'd say it's a buy it, honestly. I enjoyed my time with it.
I have been telling people to check this game out since I reviewed it last year and highlighting it whenever it goes on sale and evangelizing Turnip Boy.
Now it's on Game Pass.
Activating ways.
Now it's on Game Pass.
Yeah. So do it up. All right, next up is Anuchar, developed by Stellar Null, published by Freedom Games, that released April 21st on Xbox One, Series X and S, Switch, and PC for $14.99. Anuchar has fallen. Generations after the fall, its surviving descendants have chosen you as the bell wielder of the magical Audros Bell? Audros Bell, I guess.
Your guess is as good as mine.
Go forth, battle monsters, solve puzzles, and restore Anuchar to its former glory, a paradise in the skies. Tim, tell us about Anuchar.
All right, Anuchar. Took me a while to kind of like, I don't know, figure out what was going on in this game. There's a lot of story and world building going on. Which I guess I'll say is probably the best stuff in the game. Like, I think it has a really cool look to it. I like the way the characters are designed. They all have these like just blank white faces on them. But just like the way they're drawn looks really cool. I like the way the world is drawn and laid out. It's reminiscent of kind of early 3D era. Like pushing into, you know, from the transition from 2D to 3D, but not full 3D. So think like the backgrounds in this game are not pre-rendered, but they kind of remind me of that, like at least when you're in the town area. And it looks cool. And there is some interesting stuff going on with kind of the lore in the town. And it's just, I don't know. I guess I didn't expect that much. Like up front, the game is very chatty with you about what's going on in the game. And setting it up, but that's good and fine. what's less good and fine is what you're doing most of the time in the game. So the game is a, I kind of just kept waiting for the game to take off, as it were, and it never really did. Like, they drop you into a piece of combat, like, very, like, I think it's like the first thing in the game. It's like, boom, here's some combat and here's the buttons. And you're like, oh, okay. And the point is that you die, and then it's like your character's having a nightmare or some shit. But so basically you're going through these kind of overhead, Zelda-ish, dungeons. Your character has this bell that he wields, which is, you know, for all intents and purposes, like a club, except it kind of makes a dongy sound when you do certain things. You're called the bell wielder. You have a light attack. You have a heavy attack, which is also sort of a dodge at the same time. You have another thing that floats around with you. But that's really it. And just like your light attack, 3-hit combo, you're just mashing on light attack, and kind of the way the heavy attack works. And like I said, like when you push heavy attack, and I didn't realize at first that this was heavy attack, because when you push the button, you just kind of do a dodge. But if you are near something you can strike with the bell, like an enemy or certain objects in the world, then you will do a heavy attack, which will then knock that object or enemy back. But again, it's context sensitive, and I found it to be touchy, and it doesn't seem to have a lot of like invincibility frames on it. So it's like I'd be moving into heavy attack an enemy, but they'd hop at me and attack at the same time, and I would take damage and then whack them. And just the problem is like the combat and the exploration is the that's what you're doing in the game. And there's puzzle solving as well. That is a big part. I shouldn't glaze over that. But like, when all you got, I kept waiting for like more abilities to appear, really to spice up the combat, because a lot of those dungeons, like the puzzles are pretty simple. But you know, sometimes it's just kind of locking you in rooms with enemies that you got to clear before you move on to the next room that locks and is full of enemies. And, you know, there's some enemies that you have to hit with that strong attack to knock them back against the wall to knock off some armor. But otherwise, and sometimes you have to do that multiple times. But that's just kind of, it's like go in a room. Oh, here's some enemies. Oh, there's one with armor. I'm going to knock him back. Then do my little 3-hit combo over here. Do this thing over here. Sometimes there's an object in the room that you can smack around. But that's it. And it just doesn't have a good groove or feel to it. I'm going to sneeze. Am I going to sneeze?
Do it.
Nope. No, nah, I think it went away.
Damn it.
I'm just going to drink some water instead.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, it ends up feeling like more of a grind than it's just grinding through these levels, do some puzzles, go into some fight rooms, move on with this really limited combat system. Like I said, the story is cool. The look of it is cool, but just playing it, I just kept like waiting for it to like really start doing something, and it just didn't. The game forces you have to manually save in this game if you want to close out of the game and have it save your progress. And saving is a thing you do when you're not in a dungeon. So when you are in a dungeon, you have to rely, and if you have to put the game down, you have to rely on putting the system to sleep. And the game does explicitly tell you that, but fucking come on, it's 2022, man.
Give us a suspend option.
Yeah, give us a suspend option. Put checkpoints in the dungeon. I mean, like when you die, you don't go back to the save point. You can if you want, but I would recommend not doing that. It will checkpoint you at the beginning of a floor or at the beginning of the dungeon, but like if you quit out, no.
Damn.
So yeah, it's kind of a bummer, and it just ends up being like aggravating to play, unfortunately.
Well, $15, what do you think?
I don't think you should buy this unless you're, I mean, if you really want to dig into that story, go nuts. But if you're looking for a fun dungeon crawly thing, this ain't it.
Ah, well,
Ah, well, they can't all
well,
be.
Son of a bitch.
Son of a fucking goddamn.
Ah, god fucking damn, here, son of a bitch. Son of a bitch. All right, Tim, that's it for you. We will see you. Oh, all right, go night-night, and we'll see you next week. Do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, I'm very excited to talk about the game that I have to review next week. I haven't started the game I have to review the week after that yet. I'm trying to front load it because my child's birthday is a week from Sunday. So there's birthday festivities. So I got to like get through these games ahead of time. But
you should know that pretty much everyone is jealous of the games you get. So,
I want to know what this game is.
It's a little bit roguish and it has a good legacy. And you should look forward to hearing about it.
You sly devil. That was great.
I have no idea what he's talking about.
I mean, whatever, it's been in fucking early access for like 2 years, so it's not like people haven't been playing it. So
yeah, embargoes are fun.
Embargoes are embargoes, so yeah, we'll talk about it next week.
Yay.
On another episode of the SML podcast.
But there's more of this one, so don't leave. Just me. I'm the only one leaving. Good night.
All right, next up is Godlike Burger, developed by Liquid Pug, developed by Daedalic Entertainment, released April 21st on Steam for $19.99. In Godlike Burger, you run the craziest restaurant of the galaxy, stun, poison, and kill customers in many devious ways and turn them into burger meat. And don't worry, alien customers will keep coming if you're smart about it, because cannibalism is just too damn tasty. Ian, what's going on in Godlike Burger?
Well, it's interesting because at first I kind of went in with like a it's because at first you want to kind of compare it to Overcooked, and in a way it kind of sort of is, but it's not quite as frenetic. But yeah, basically you have this little dining establishment, and like when I first started playing it, like one of the first things that I kind of got freaked out by was the fact, you know, trying to keep track of orders, because in your establishment, you have various rooms where various activities can be indulged in by your patrons. You have restrooms if they have to go to the bathroom. You have kind of like a back alley where sometimes they'll go out and smoke. You have a little dance floor over in one room, and you have like a robo stripper pole that's nearby.
So it's not just Overcooked. It's like sim elements as well.
Yeah. Well, I'll
minor sim elements.
Yeah. Cause like one of the first things I struggled with was, realizing that the order that people show up to your establishment isn't the same, order that they'll order food. If that makes any sense. So basically you'll have like, let's just say four guys walk in and they'll be, you know, they'll pop up in the customer queue in the corner of the HUD. But three of those guys might just kind of putter fuck off. One guy might go to the slot machine. One guy might go to the arcade. One guy might make a bolt straight for the fucking robo stripper. And then it's the fourth guy that places his order for food. And then number two comes in and places his order. And then number three comes in. And then the first guy that comes in finally places his order. So you have to be very cognizant of who's ordering what. And admittedly, like it took a little bit to adjust to that. And also, like, I kind of feel that the customer queue could be, I don't know, I don't want to say streamlined, but like I said, it took me a few rounds to really wrap my head around what I was looking at, because you have to, because it shows like a little icon of the burger and the ingredients therein. So you have to kind of eyeball that, look at the number that they're ordering, and then just kind of mentally step yourself through a process. And like I said, you know, when it's Overcooked, it's like, you know, this guy walks in, he wants a burger, this is what he wants on it, make it fast, get it out of here, clean up the dish, who's up next? But here you kind of have to sit there and kind of watch them and make sure that you know, place the orders for the right tickets, because when you make your food, you put it into this serving machine, I guess. And basically you assign it to whatever ticket number that person has. And it's kind of nice because they'll eventually wander in and grab it. And I remember at first I was kind of a little like almost on tilt because it's like I'm rushing around trying to make all these fucking burgers and trying to, you know, like how the hell am I going to have any time to fucking kill anybody? And at first it's kind of rough because you literally have to just kind of wait till one person's by themselves in a corner of the restaurant while no one else is ordering and just fucking cleave the shit out of them, dispose of their body, and then try to sneak back to the public sink and wash the blood off without being spotted. And at first when you start off, it takes a while to wash that blood off. But what I kind of realized is that I don't necessarily have to worry about killing people off at first because you have a pretty nice starting stock. So you can kind of focus on just making money. And then what you do with that money is you can purchase esoteric traps. And there are various upgrades to these traps. Like, for example, you start off with a dumpster gun. Basically, there's a shotgun duct taped to the dumpster out back. And if someone happens to be smoking in the right spot, you can just kind of walk back there, trigger it. They get shot. And the advantage to this is that you don't get blood all over yourself. So you don't have to clean up after yourself. Because that's usually the trickiest part, because the sink is sort of, it's not in the main dining area, but it's kind of like in a central crossroads of the restaurant. So like usually if someone's going to the dance parlor, they have to go through there. If someone has to go to one of the two bathrooms, they have to pass by the sink. If anyone wants to use the arcade machine, they have to pass. But, you know, it's like a central location. So you have to be very tactful about how you use it. But eventually you can buy up a lot of interesting upgrades like motion sensors. So it'll go off without you having to run back and manually trigger it. And then another upgrade is auto disposal. So when someone walks back, triggers the trap, they get killed, and the body immediately gets disposed of. Now, once you kill someone, they kind of go into a processing queue as their bodies get harvested for the appropriate parts. And you kind of have to wait it out. Now, in my playthrough, I didn't quite get too far because I didn't get off the first planet, and I'll kind of get to that in a moment. But like one of the best traps that I picked up starting off was the tentacle toilet.
Oh, and, Lord.
Yep. And basically I kind of saved up a buttload of money, bought the tentacle toilet, bought the motion sensor, and you can actually manually adjust the, you know, turn on and off the motion sensor. So if it feels like you're killing way too many people, because, well, that's actually one of the things you have to be on the lookout for, because like I said, someone might wander into the wander into your diner, putter fuck around for a couple minutes and order food. But if they go to the wrong place at the wrong time, you just killed off a customer that hasn't paid you any money yet.
Yeah.
So,
well, if you kill them, can't you just steal their money?
No, you cannot.
What the fuck?
Because it's interesting, because what there's two opportunities for you to get money. They immediately pay for the burger when they pick it up at the counter. They sit down, they'll eat it, and based on whether or not they like the food, or, you know, like if you give them like a burnt burger, or if you give them a burger made with an ingredient that they're not fond of, because there's like a whole like racial hold on, that didn't quite sound right. a species profile for each alien race, and some of them like certain types of meat, some of them do not like certain types of meat. And you can kind of like fill out the activities that they're prone to doing, so you can custom tailor your restaurant to be more efficient at harvesting. And it's actually pretty in depth, like not so much that it's overwhelming, but it's sort of like, you know, I'm on this planet. We have the rat guys, we have the veggie guys, and we have the handsome Squidward looking guys. And some of those guys are like immune to certain types of damage. So you kind of have to figure out, you know, which traps would work best for killing these guys without being too obvious about it. And sometimes the traps that are best at killing them are installed in certain devices that they're not interested in playing around with. Like, for example, let's just say Handsome Squidward. Like, one of the best ways to kill him is ganking him with the hookah in the VIP room. Except the problem is that they're not interested in token up. So another thing you can do is build sauces. And these sauces have a little timer on them, and they will have very oddly specific effects that will force your customers to react appropriately. For example, there is a nicotine sauce that will make them want to go out and smoke. There's a laxative sauce that will make them run to the bathroom. There's a there's a poison sauce which will damage them, and there is like a first aid kit in the restaurant, so if they take damage, whether it's from you or even another customer, because one thing that I couldn't figure out was that some of my customers were on every so often getting mugged. It's like, oh, that's a thing. I'm not quite sure how to, stop that, but, you know, it is what it is. But like, if they get injured, they'll run to the first aid station, and you can actually turn the first aid station into a trap in and of itself. It's really expensive and it'll automatically kill them, but there's no motion sensor and there's no auto disposal, so it's like a high risk, high reward kind of deal. Okay, so yeah, so there's a little bit of the Overcooked where you're trying to build the burgers, and basically you're trying to make money and you're trying to make prestige, and you need certain amounts of both in order to progress to the next planet in the system. And obviously, as you keep going planet to planet to planet, the difficulty ramps up. And the and how they ramp up the difficulty is that there are, trying to think how to blanket this whole thing, there are funky complications. Like, for example, backed up toilets. Every so often, someone will go up, plug up your toilet, and it'll start overflowing. Once the toilets are overflowing, no one will use the toilets. So pretty much anything you have set up in the toilets is null and void. So you have to run back, plunge them out, run back, get back into the flow of things. Also, there are protesters. Basically, hippy dippy aliens will run in with these little protest signs and run up to your customers and rant and rave until your customer decides, fuck this, I'm out, and leave without buying anything. And then you have thieves. Basically, since your restaurant is doing so good, your rivals are getting pissed off. So every so often, they'll try to run into your restaurant, run to the fridge, and steal your fucking ingredients.
Oh, God.
And then, and like I said, I'm only on the first planet, so those are the only ones that I personally had to deal with. Looking at some of the other planets, there's like a laundry list of like up to like 10 different things going on, because I saw one for zombies, I saw one for bugs. Some of the icons, I couldn't even extrapolate what the fuck they possibly could mean. And, the
how
aliens
themselves...
How many
planets are there?
I want to say, off the top of my head, I want to say like 6 to 7, give or take.
So there's some content to keep you going.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, as you keep going, the aliens get more oddly specific with their immunities and their weaknesses. And, and like I said, in order to build. Yeah. And I forgot to mention the prestige. Basically, after someone eats at your restaurant, based upon how fast and timely you make their meal, how delicious it is in accordance to their preferences, and how fast they get out, they will basically give you like an intergalactic Yelp review. And so that's another reason why you don't necessarily want to just go on a fucking hobo murder spree, because you do want to feed a bunch of people. You do want them to make sure that they have a really good experience. Oh, that's another one. Critics. You get food critics on the down low.
Oh, God.
So it's one of those things where you don't want to kill them, because it's a really good way to get bonuses, because if your Overcooked game is really strong and you're able to serve all these guys up and get them out in a nice, quick, efficient manner, like you get like a super crazy bonus to your prestige. Whereas if they have a real shit time, you'll actually lose a fucking buttload of prestige because of it.
And that's when you murder
them. Yeah. And if you murder them too, because they never got back to say either way. So, but yeah, it is definitely interesting. It is definitely fun. I mean, like I said, it takes a little while to kind of really get your head around how everything works and the pacing of everything. And granted, I'm not like a, pro MLG Overcooked player. You know that for certain. Because we've threatened people. It's like, hey, if you don't behave, you're going to play Overcooked with me.
We got to get you and Jacob to play together.
But I feel that if you're into Overcooked and you can make the adjustments that Godlike Burger has, you could have a lot of fun with it.
Ooh, well, it's $20. What are your thoughts on it?
I would definitely say try it. Like I said, if you're into that genre, that style of game, I would definitely try it. I'm trying to think, $20. Yeah, I'd say if you're into it, I'd say buy it. If you're kind of on a fence, I'd give it a tentative try.
Cool. Well, that is it for you. Were you going to stick around or are you heading out?
Yeah, I can stick around.
Cool beans. Then we are going to move on. Next game to talk about is Androdunos 2, developed by Pickering Soft, published by Just for Games and Pixel Heart, released March 24th on Switch for $19.99. In Androdunos 2, players take control of the Yellow Cherry once more, set to end the long war with the aliens once and for all. Chris, you covered this last time. Purnell, you're going to talk about it this time. Tell us about
it. Once and for all.
Yes, once and for all. We got the game again, so we're going to talk about it again. That's how we do things. We get another code, fuck it. We'll get someone else's opinion on the game. So, Purnell, tell us about this one.
I'll tell you about it once and for all. I just caught up in how you described it in the description. I couldn't help it.
Hey, anyway. That's what the game page says.
Hey, you better believe it forever. So this game, apparently this is a sequel to a game I've actually never played before. So I came into this without any knowledge of the legacy or the lineage that this comes with. With that said, I'm kind of happy that that's the case, because that means I can judge it on its own merits and not based on how I perceive it should have followed its predecessor.
The other thing is that nobody really played the original game. It's from 1993.
I played the original game.
Did you?
No,
like, wait a minute.
But I could have.
I wanted to.
But I'm going to guess that the 1993, it wasn't a matter of it being just like, you know, because old game, more like maybe it was also an obscure game back then, too.
Yeah, more or less. It was fairly 93, obscure.
Even if I did hear of it, like, I doubt it was anything crazy, go nuts special.
Is a schmuck.
Most people would use a time machine to go back and kill Hitler. I would use a time machine to go play the original Androdunos in arcades.
In all fairness, Hitler was long dead by then.
True.
You wouldn't have had to have that on your to-do list.
Well, after you've killed Hitler and after you've played Androdunos 1, you can come up to the present day and play its sequel, which takes place in the form of a ship, apparently called the Cherry Ship or something Cherry.
Yellow cherry
blasting through 10 shootinous, rootinous, tootinous stages of gun-powered madness or mayhem to see the end of days. And honestly, the gunplay in this is actually really cool. Originally, when I saw screenshots, I thought it was going to be coming into something akin to like a Gradius-style game. But the reality, I mean, I know there has been a shooter like this, but I can't recall what it is. And even the one I'm thinking about doesn't do the level up system like this one does. So the ship by default from the very beginning of the game has 4 different weapon modes associated with it. I don't think the names even do them justice, because I think, but it's essentially like, it's like a forward. I think of it as like a forward shot, a back shot, a sort of spread shot, and a laser, like a piercing shot. And even though I described them in that way, they all have sub-missile type functions that do not function like you're used to hearing of a missile functioning in one of these games. Like, there is one that does fire a missile straight down, like an arc. But then there's one that's like, it fires lasers outwards to your outer perimeter and whatnot. And others like this. And as you're flying around, you'll be blasting enemies that are coming at you in formation in a 2D shoot 'em up. Typical of a shoot 'em up in that regard. However, certain enemies die or certain objects die, you'll get a power up that can essentially level up the weapon you're currently using at the time. Because you can switch between the 4 that I mentioned before with the L and R triggers. But when you pick up this power up, you'll level up the weapon. There's about, I want to say, 7 levels per weapon. And as they level up, they become more powerful, both the main gun and, particularly the main gun in this case. However, every time you die, the weapon you had equipped at the time will go down 1 level. Now, I mentioned earlier that they all have sub-functions, basically the missile function. They can level up too, but there's a different power-up that's associated with those. And when you pick up that power-up, all of your missiles level up 1 level, and they don't go down upon death like the main weapons do. Lastly, there's like a sort of, think of it like an R-type sort of shield, where it goes in front of you in one case, in another case it rotates around you, and like 2 other forms of this that you could also find by way of power up, though I generally didn't survive long enough to keep use of it for very long, because when you die, it just goes away. But you can also level up that function too. As you're killing certain patterns of enemies, you'll lastly also pick up these little blue floating orbs that will show up. And I think it's based off of every 10 you get per stage, you get 1 free power up or level up at the end of a level. Like, it'll let you choose what the level, whether it be one of your guns, your sub-weapon,
or your shield sort of thing. And I actually kind of enjoyed that because at first I thought it was just like a little like a point power up, which when it comes to these kinds of games, I was never really much into the idea of picking those up. I just wanted to actually survive to the end because I've never been doing that, or I haven't been doing that in quite a bit. But due to the fact that they also come with the power up potential, yeah, I jumped on it. And for those who do chase scores, if you feel as though you don't need to power up your ship, you can also spend those upgrade points on a free 5,000 points. So I was like, hey, if you want to go balls to the wall on this thing and get a high score, just collect orbs that give you a small point bonus and then spend those orbs on a bigger point bonus. Hi-oh. And at the end of every level, there's a typical boss fight, though. I did like the bosses in this game because they are damaged sponges. You're not going to just like do like the brr, 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 it's gone. No, you're going to have to work for some of these guys. And the further the game you get, the more jerkish they become, too. The one thing I did like that can help you with some of these jerky bosses is that I mentioned the different guns you get and how you can level those guns up. But what I have not mentioned until now is the Hyper Shot, which is a super version of every gun you get. When you decide you want to use it, you press the Hyper Shot button. You'll use that weapon's form of Super Shot. And that's basically like a different, it sometimes fires in a different formation. It other times, it's all times it matter, it's just more powerful. So you're going to hurt things. It can also burn off incoming projectiles too. So there's been a number of cases where I broke it out solely to survive a bullet barrage. However, due to the fact that you don't have to really particularly pay anything for this use, it does have a different price in the form of when it wears off, the weapon you use when you triggered it is weaker to fire for a certain period of time. And it's indicated by the fact that the number level for the weapon displays as red, basically saying this weapon's handicapped until it wears off. And while the supercharged shot is charging for another use. So it kind of incentivizes the player to juggle between weapons, maybe even use a super shot on a weapon that has a good super, but not necessarily as much as important for the main function of the weapon when you go back to having to fire your normal gun again. All in all, I came to find this game to be pretty engaging. It has three difficulty levels for people who want to challenge or want to softball through it. You got pretty much each continue can have two lives, and there's up to like nine continues where you default to five. So for the most part, every person I believe could see the end of this game just between the credits option and the difficulty settings. But of course, if you're going to be playing for like scores and stuff like that, or if you want the challenge of it all, I mean, being like me, I just went with arcade difficulty, which is the second one, and pushed through as best I could. And I still enjoyed myself because I've always felt like, I wonder if Chris feels the same way, that when it comes to shmups, I feel less inclined to want the easiest version of it because they give you like a small number of stages. In this case, the game gives you 10. But if you put it on the easiest, you'll blast the games in like an hour maybe at the highest, which kind of takes away from the whole push to see further mastery of the game, which is what usually extends the life of a shmup play. So I don't know. I stuck with arcade difficulty. What did you think of that idea, Chris? That concept?
Yeah. No, I'm into that. I definitely like when they include easy mode because it's really nice to bring like, you know, new people into the genre. Cause you know, they're tough.
They can be intimidating.
Yeah. But it's like once you kind of get into like the genre as a whole, then yeah, totally fine to like, you know, just start it off on the hard difficulty and power through, you know. That's kind of what's cool about the genre. It's a little bit for everyone in that respect. Even though it's marketed as like a total niche thing.
Well, hopefully Chris, anything you want to chime in on Andrew Dunos?
Just that my 3DS copy shipped, so I'll be looking forward to getting that at some point.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah.
Well, it's $20 for now.
I wanted to add one last thing that I totally forgot to mention, and that is while we were talking about getting people having an opportunity to get the hang of stuff and getting into the game. One feature in this game that I do like is that once you reach the stage, you can select that stage to go right back to it and play it, which means that it's a good way to get familiar with the bullet patterns and enemy patterns on that level to sort of get better at it. And then when you want to go for a full score run again, you start from the beginning and you just blow through with the knowledge you've built up instead of having to like get the stage 5 each time you want to practice it.
Yeah, and they don't penalize you for that either. You can just start the game on like stage 3 or whatever and just keep going.
Yeah, and I do love that a lot. Like literally the only thing that would be a problem there is if you're a score chaser, because you'll miss the opportunity to get points on the previous levels. But if you're just trying to see the end for now, or just get a feel for how the game flows, you're likely not going to be all that concerned about points just yet, so much as just, I want to succeed. So,
yeah.
But honestly, I think this game is legit. This is a very solid shmup. And one thing worth adding in regards to that is, like, there's a lot of shmups that have come out over the years, and much of them run the formula of main gun, bomb, main gun, bomb. I feel like it's been a while since I've seen a shmup come along. It's like, here, you have multiple weapon systems. Get used to all of them. And this one even still does it a little differently than even games that do that. So this actually brings something new to the table in addition to just being solid gameplay.
Which is funny, because it's actually, it's like, it's something old to the table, but like, it's been so long that now it's new again. Because like, Glaylancer and Darius have like the different types of shots, and or like the different types of shots and the level up system respectively.
Yeah, but like, the thing is, like, because they've been, it's been a while. I think that's another, the Darius collection that came out recently, didn't it?
I don't know about recently. It's been a while now, I think, but yeah.
So get on this game.
There you go. And apparently it's going to be coming to Xbox based on what I'm reading. It's supposed to be hitting everything. So hopefully it hurries up. But nice. Next game to talk about is Skabma Snowfall, developed by Red Stage Entertainment, published by PID Games and Sunsoft, released April 22nd on Steam for $19.99. The Rhythm of Nature is in Danger. I couldn't say these names with teeth, so I'm not going to bother trying them now. Chris, just tell us about Skabma Snowfall.
Okay, Skabma Snowfall, which I looked at the early build a few weeks ago, so a few episodes ago, so you can, you know, get into that if you want to. But I'm going to repeat a lot of what I said. mostly because I didn't realize this until I went to go play this game again. I was like, oh, because it updated to the full version, it erased all of my save data, so I had to start all over again.
No.
That's okay, though. It's a good game, so. And it wasn't especially hard to get to where I was, because I just skipped some of the story that I'd already seen. So yeah, Skabma Snowfall. This is a... it's an unusual thing to happen. It is an actual video game about an indigenous person made by indigenous people. So it's a, you know, one hesitates to like throw around words like authentic, but that's almost like unique. But let's just say it's legit. So Skabma Snowfall is the story of a Sami person who is named Ailu. I believe that's it. They actually don't say their name too often, so that's the thing about this, though, is that the game is entirely voice acted and narrated, even, and it's all done in the actual language of the Sami people. So there are subtitles, of course, but you know, sometimes it's hard to catch those nouns until you're really listening. But anyways, so I can't promise to have it all pronounced all that well myself either, so that's, oh well. What can you do? So this is a game that is basically an adventure platformer, little bit of a collectathon almost, but because it does have side quests that do involve collecting pieces of things, try to collect all of the certain thing. And it follows Ailu as they basically start off the journey going to look for a runaway reindeer, because they fell asleep because of, they've been having nightmares, and, you know, so they're having trouble sleeping at night. So they fall asleep while on reindeer guard duty. And of course, a reindeer runs away, so you have to chase them down. Stuff happens. You end up in a rock slide and you fall into a cave where you then find an ancient skeleton that is holding onto a drum. You pick up this drum and you find out it's a Noaidi drum, which I believe is the pronunciation. That is basically a shaman, a healer, as it goes. And so you start playing this drum, and it actually, you know, you're in a dark cave, and suddenly the cave's like lit up. So this drum does things. It lights up things, soon after, you start running into basically a kind of like, it's hard to say, like a plague. It's actually, it's easy to put in like Fern Gully terms, you know. It's like that, how it was like that liquidy kind of pollution that, you know, kind of sticks to everything. It's a little bit like that, except that it also kind of has like glowy bits and stuff, but it's like, it's, they mistaken it for tar at first. So it's just this viscous kind of black stuff that infects people and causes them to get really, really sick. But the cool thing is that your drum, combined with some other mystical powers that you achieve, that you acquire along your adventure, will actually get rid of those things. And so you're basically going around, you know, basically going from like, you know, a landmark to landmark kind of deal. And then, you know, you have a constantly updating like checklist of things to do and in the main quest. And a lot of it, you know, just, there's a whole lot of like points where you can just kind of stop and have your character explain something to you about like, you know, what's this house for? What's this structure? You know, and you find out, you know, about this character, but also you find out actual lore and like actual facts about, you know, about this people, that they're basically the indigenous people of this kind of Scandinavian area that incorporates like Norway and some other countries. I don't know my geography. But if you watch the film Frozen 2, it's those same people. But anyways, so yeah, it's really kind of cool. The graphics are really nice. It's got this very nice, like, you know, because it's Scandinavian, you have like northern lights and, you know, these really lovely looking trees and like great, you know, scenery and stuff. And, you know, a lot of times you're like walking up a mountain, so like you kind of see the scenery like open up a lot and really pretty to look at. The characters are a little bit more stylized to kind of look like, you know, an animated film rather than, you know, realistic looking. But and yeah, the cool thing is, you know, using the drum and acquiring like different powers to like go, you know, all around and fix stuff. You know, you start off just playing the drum just to like look at footprints to go find, you know, your missing cousin. But then like later on, it's like you're using your drum as well as like the ability to like do a dash that lets you dash in like midair. And then the combination of the two like creates this kind of wind attack kind of deal. The game's not violent, though. It's just you against some pollution, as far as I know. So it's not like, you know, you're not like hurting people or anything. But yeah, it's a really cool story told through an interesting lens. And then with a, you know, with a little side dish of, let's go find all of my cousin's rabbits, or let's all and let's no go find the local behind. Let's go find the torn pages of the local white explorer's like diary.
Oh God.
Yeah, there's one of those.
No,
but
the game's,
it's okay because he's nice, I guess.
Well, the game's $20. What are your final thoughts on this one?
Yeah, definitely go pick this one up. Especially if you're, like I said, if you're interested in like these kind of adventure games, you know, really cool stuff. But especially like go pick it up because it's really worth supporting like an endeavor like this. You know, so, you know, these games made by, you know, actual indigenous people that are telling their story through software. It's a really cool thing that I think should be supported. So yeah, this has my heartiest buy it.
Cool. And yeah. Hopefully we see it come to more platforms in the future.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. I would love to play this on you know, something else besides my computer.
All right, well, next up is Bit Orchard Animal Valley, developed by Two Boon Games, published by Red Deer Games, released April 22nd on Xbox One, Series X and S, and Switch for $6.99. Sell your apples to earn money and improve your orchard, expand your land, and find new secrets. Who knows, maybe you'll make a new friend along the way. Purnell, tell us about Bit Orchard.
Bit Orchard is, I guess the best way to describe this would be like a clicker that has walking, because you'll be doing a lot of tasks to accomplish your goals. Your main character shows up at an orchard or a empty field that could become an orchard, and he is tasked with the list of tasks, actually, that the game gives you from the very onset of the game. You start off with a small bit of money and the request to do a few things, such as plant some apples or sell some apples and improve your home and so on and so forth. The day itself, as you play, runs on a cycle of like 24 hours, or not even 24 hours. It starts at like 7 a.m. in the morning. It ends at 11 o'clock at night. And throughout each of those days, you're able to perform like a number of functions in your, I guess, what the time allows or what you can fit in. You have four tools or two tools, a sickle or scythe rather, which can be used to chop up weeds that grow periodically throughout the day. You can get a watering can, which you use to water the plants that you place into the ground or the apple trees you place into the ground. And then the two other things you can select on the main inventory list or action list is the plant apple seed function and the grab function or pickup function. So as you're running around, you'll be dropping these seeds down, watering them, clearing weeds, and then going to bed. As you wake up the next day, you'll do it again. And as time progresses, a few little things will start to happen. Like, for example, as trees start to grow and apples begin to form on them, you'll start to notice crows showing up. Crows will try to eat your apples. You don't want them to do that, so you have to stop them by putting up scarecrows, which you build by using the weed fiber that you've been chopping up this whole time to construct it. Again, you'll be producing, selling, preventing crows from taking the goods, and also doing that along with a few other miscellaneous things on your task list until you complete that task list. Once you've done so, a whole new task list shows up with new functions, and you'll proceed to go about those things. And early on, the game seems kind of small. Like, well, I'm planting apples, and I'm making the motions, whatever. In fact, you'll likely have many days where you'll go to sleep on your own accord before the clock runs up because you'll have done everything the day that you'd want to do in your day before the clock runs up. But as you begin to proceed and your goals change, you'll start to notice that the world map expands a bit more. You'll start coming across more people. You'll start coming across like weird things like a treasure map that says there's a thing here. Decipher it and find the secret to this clue. Or you might come across a friend who wants you to provide something for them, which will then change your dynamic for how you proceed to do things. Hell, even your orchard. Early on, the game is pretty freaking easy just to water all your plants. But then as it starts to grow, you'll need to start creating sprinklers in order to do the watering for you because you won't have time to water all of your plants. You'll be busy. The game will keep you very busy. And it's interesting because at first I found myself feeling like, this is kind of dumb. Like, I don't really feel myself enjoying this very much. But as the farm began to expand, and I started getting more tasks and getting that itch of like, all right, I can be more efficient. If I put these sprinklers up here, I don't have to water this section of the ground anymore. So you're not going to go out and explore the area outside of my main yard without worrying about, watering all my plants, which was taking up half of my day. Now I can finally put some clothes on and look different. Just stuff like that.
Brunel, you should probably have clothes on. Let's be honest.
I mean, not that we're going to shame nude farming, but.
You shouldn't, because new farming is how you both grow the best crops. or the best cocks, but that's a whole other joke.
That's a whole different farm there, buddy.
That's a whole other farm. But this game ends up scratching that nice itch. And honestly, the music is not bad either. It's pretty good bitty. It plays like in a constant loop, but there's a radio inside your house that you can just walk up to and say, I want to change the station. And when you change the station, it changes the music. So there are a number of 8-bit tunes that'll play, or more reminiscent of a Game Boy tune, honestly.
Visually, really it looks nice. Like Game Boy 2. So.
Oh, yeah. It's the whole motif. And that's the kind of took me back to when my first Harvest Moon, which was actually the Game Boy Color version of the game, not the SNES game. So it was definitely giving me I remember all this. It makes me feel kind of good.
That's so funny. I'm actually playing the Super Nintendo version of that right now.
Like, literally right now.
Like, literally, I have it paused on my TV at this moment.
Of all the freaking games you can be playing right now, which, don't get me wrong, it's a great game. But I'm surprised you're like, I want to play Harvest Moon right now.
Yeah, the urge strikes sometimes. I mean, it's no nude farming, but...
That is true. That is true. But then again, what is nude
farming? That's when you look to the mod community.
They got what it takes to make your game shine. I want to play Harvest Moon 64 again myself. It's been forever. But I do genuinely feel as though this game has something going for it. Obviously, if you're looking for like a Stardew Valley or the aforementioned Harvest Moons, you're not getting that here. If you're looking for a more retro-tinked, what were farming games like before they started having you marry a spouse and find fairies under rocks or whatever? this could be more your speed. And honestly, the visuals aren't bad either. I mean, they have a very pleasant, warming retro vibe to them. I found myself overall pleased with this game.
Cool. Well, it is $6. What are your thoughts?
I think it is a buy. Get those crows off your apples, drop your draws, and grow some crops.
Cool beans. Literally, word. Cool beans. Beans that you farm. All right, we got one
final. Your beans will get cool if you do more of that nude farming.
Nude beans, baby. So wholesome.
You're all terrible. All right, we got one final game to talk about tonight, and that is a preview of Time on Frog Island, developed by Half Past Yellow, published by Merge Games. This one is coming out May 10th on the Switch and Steam for $19.99. A terrible storm ravages the seas around you, casting your mighty vessel into the perilous rocks of a nearby island. You wake to find your ship in pieces, shipwrecked on a strange island filled with frogs?
Frogs?
Chris, we get an early look at this one. What's going on in this game?
This is basically one of those kind of games that does exactly what it says on the tin, which is a phrase I still have not gotten tired of. So, yes, you play as a character. As far as I know, he doesn't have a name. He's just a little sea captain. It's kind of funny because he kind of looks like a 15-year-old boy, but also has like this deep, you know, voice, but also speaks gibberish, but also with kind of a French accent. It's like it's hard to describe, but I think when you play the game, you'll get the impression that this is a deep-voiced French 15-year-old with a beard and a pipe. Not a beard, actually. He's got like sideburns, though. Anyway,
they age differently in France.
Very true. Yeah, they get old quick. Anyways, yeah, you basically run aground on a on an island that is entirely populated by frogs. The problem is you cannot talk to these frogs because they, I guess you don't speak the same language. I mean, your guy just speaks, you know, smoky gibberish. So it's kind of, and the frogs, you know, who knows? They kind of have their own thing going.
Maybe a frog is in its throat.
Oh. No, it's not that kind of game.
No.
So, but anyways, so you quickly find out that in order to, and it's kind of great how this game communicates all this stuff entirely without text. There's not any text in the game, even though, funny enough, so, you know, I was given the Japanese version of this game, and I downloaded it and was told, you know, it's okay, there's no text, so you can totally read it and stuff. It actually still has English language options.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, but the only text is in the menu, so it just literally they just slapped on an English menu and that's it. So, yeah, you entirely communicate through like word bubbles with pictures in them. You want something from a frog because it will help you get your ship repaired. And of course, your guy does take an inventory of like all the things that need to be repaired, you know, on day one. And the frog might respond and give you a picture of something else. So it's your task to go elsewhere on the island and somehow figure out how to get that other thing that that frog wants. You can do this by maybe you have to trade something else with another frog in order to get something else to trade with another frog and another frog. You know, they've got, you know, those kind of Zelda-esque like trade sequences going on there. But also there's like some items that actually affect other items. Like you can actually, and sometimes you'll just find something laying around. The entire adventure is all about like trying to figure out like what all convoluted steps you need to make in order to get the certain item to get to trade with a certain frog to get a certain piece of your boat back so that you can sail off and you know and leave Frog Island forever. So the game, the cool thing about it is that basically the whole of the island is accessible. There are some things, like sometimes you do need a certain item to get to a certain place, but for the most part, you can just walk around just about anywhere. The frogs also kind of move around the island a little bit. So you may like find someone in a different place or even different people, depending on where and when it is, because the game also operates on a day and night cycle. And, you know, eventually your guy really wants to go to sleep. So you have to find like a campsite and, you know, find three pieces of wood and put them on a you know, like a fire area, and then as soon as you put the third wood down, it just like spontaneously combusts into this like roaring, you know, campfire, which is
as fires usually do. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Well, I was like, I guess this game takes place in California too. But anyways.
Womp womp.
Yeah, womp womp. The state's on fire.
Yeah. Well, we don't want to talk about this one too much content wise. Visually, it looks really cute. How's the audio? Yep.
Audio's good. It, like I said, the animation's really cute too. Actually, I love the way the guy like runs. He kind of runs elbows out, and it's like if you're swimming, then he like sticks his pipe above the water, kind of like a snorkel, even though it's just his tobacco pipe. He's like, anyway, yeah, the sound is cool because like, you know, the frogs have like their language. You have your language. It's got like this pretty cool music. It's not real extreme or anything like that. It's, you know, it's, I would call it like jaunty and ambient, but,
fucking but yeah, yeah,
like this game is really coming together nicely. And yeah, I'm very much not like mentioning any specifics on like the puzzles or anything like that. I'm just saying there are puzzles. So, there
well,
you go.
It's, my notes said it was priced at $20. I'm looking at the Nintendo store and it's showing it's $24.99 on there. So we'll find out, if Steam is cheaper or if it's, I found an earlier price and it went up. I don't know.
I think that it's actually that there's a physical version that's going to come out for $29.99.
That makes sense.
That's at least what Google is showing me. So I'm thinking that this is going to be like, you know, it's a full game, but you know, it's priced higher because of the physical version.
Yeah, well, we'll make a verdict on the price as it comes in the future. But for now, should we keep our eyes on this?
Absolutely, yeah. Make sure to check this one out because this should really interest point and click fans. Even though it's what I like to call a walk and click, because you know you're picking up stuff instead of like you know clicking things and putting them in an inventory. You're basically kind of carrying like one thing across the island at once. But I like it. It reminds me a lot of, there's actually a Love Delic game from, on the PlayStation 2 called Tulip, which, was this one of those weird ass games by the company that would eventually become Onion. And, it was like where you played a guy who like,
do you have
went
that?
Around huh?
You have that?
I do have that. Yeah.
You know who else has it?
Who?
Fucking Jacob.
Oh,
he has it sealed.
Wow.
Yeah. And he had no clue it was worth anything.
It used to not be. I passed it up for $10 back.
I know. They used to sell it at Five Below.
Yeah.
And now it's worth hundreds.
Yeah. Yeah.
What game is this?
Tulip.
Tulip. C-H-U-L-I-P.
Oh, jealous. The freaking kissing mailman game.
Yep.
Yes. That is exactly it. And this game reminds me of that, except instead of kissing people, you're doing trades
with frogs.
Maybe you're kissing them. I don't know. I haven't played that far into it.
Behind closed lily pads.
Well, we'll talk about this one more next month. But for now, we are done with this episode. We made it through another one. Ian, thanks for coming on and joining us and hanging out with us. Thanks again to Tim for being here. Chris and Purnell, thank you two for being here. Thanks to everyone for listening. As always, if you have anything to say to us, you could shoot an email to the smlpodcast@gmail.com. Figure I might as well throw that out there and maybe someone will reply to me and make me read stuff now that I can't talk.
Save Joe a phone call. Send an email instead.
Ian, what kind of music should we play to end this?
I don't know, something heavy metal.
Something new,
something metal. I don't know, I'll find something. Anyone have any final words to end the show?
Don't trust anyone that can spell gonorrhea on the first try.
I don't know, man. That's shit, you're right.